I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Thomas Piketty, the French economist who has captured the conversation on inequality, marks the spot where big data comes to a sharp point that we can all understand. His book on capital in the 21st century has had a sort of Harry Potter takeoff in the chattering classes, but might it also be the kind of bestseller, like Uncle Tom's Cabin, that makes history? 6 years since the meltdown and its acutely uneven effects, Thomas Piketty has come up with a villain. This youngish non-Marxist master of statistics, history, and literature says the problem in our more and more unequal world is capitalism itself. It's the age-old tendency of wealth and property to accumulate in the hands of the few faster than the many can make up with their labor. The Piketty critique has gone viral to the top of the Amazon bestseller list and the op-ed pages and the talk shows. We asked booksellers in Harvard Square this week why this book is flying off the shelves.
Well, a lot of people who come in and have just heard of the book and the title don't really even know what it's about, and so they ask us, well, what is his main theory? Like, why should I buy it?
What do you say?
We just tell a little bit about how it's his theory on wealth inequality, and since I haven't read it myself, I don't really know much more than that to say. It's funny because it's a 700-page book, and those don't usually sell this well, unless it's Harry Potter.
It's not Harry Potter, but I think we'll be sold out by tomorrow.
It's of utmost importance to anyone who is of the middle class. And I have not read the book, but it caught us, as it caught all booksellers, by surprise. But this is shaping up to be Harvard University Press's biggest seller in its 101-year history.
I haven't really read it, so I can't say what his arguments are. An 800-page economic book with hundreds of graphs and charts, and didn't expect to sell 254 copies at $40, yeah. So, I mean, we'll take it.
Pikettyism is the phenomenon to be accounted for this hour for people who've read the book and those who haven't. Mark Blythe is our political economist on the case. David Kaiser is our American historian. Vanessa Williamson is our listener at kitchen tables around the country, listening to American dreams deferred since the 08 meltdown. The shortest of short forms on Piketty's deeply detailed argument is that it confirms the biblical wisdom that became Billie Holiday's signature song: them that's got shall have, them that's not shall lose. God bless the child that's got his own. Piketty's charts underline the unequal trends in American life. In incomes, the top 1% now take 24% of the pot. In ownership, it's more extreme. The top 10% own 70% of the wealth. The top 1% owns 35% of our capital. And the gaps will get wider, Piketty argues, because the underlying rule is that the return on ownership, year in, year out, is bigger than the wages for work or the growth of the economy in general. Our guest Mark Blythe teaches political economy, which is to say the chemistry of money and power, at Brown University. He wrote the book Against the Austerity Trend in Public Finance. Mark Blythe, what's new here? What's true? And what is to be done about this Piketty diagnosis? You've read the book.
I have, in fact, read the book. Bless all right, heart. I'll admit, I've read a large chunk of it. Come on, it's 700 pages. There's other things you have to do during the day. But I've got the gist of it, shall we say, and I've probably done more than most.
How do you account for it?
All right, let's start with the first one. What's true, what's new? Let's go with what's true. Probably all of it. That's the shocking part. Now, what's new? John Cassaday from The New Yorker had a really nice way of putting it. He said, you talk about inequality with specialists, and specialists used to be the only people who talked about inequality. They were highly trained sociologists, and they knew how to do nice color quant models and economics and so on and so forth. And they had things called Thiel's entropy statistics and Gini coefficients. And what these guys did with their World Incomes database is basically look at tax returns from all over the world and piece together an incredibly simple intuitive graphs how much 1% has, 10% has, all the rest of it, and how it changes over time. So basically you have the data. The data itself is relatively incontrovertible. So one, you have arguments we used to have, which were, well, inequality is not so bad because of this, and it's not as extreme as people think, and it's really about superstars who are in the NBA. He's basically blown the whole ship up. What we have is the picture of what it actually looked like. And more importantly, we have a very, very intuitive, simple, and powerful theory as to why it got that way.
And he's talking, let's not talk superstar salaries, let's talk ownership.
Right. So basically, here's the deal. We're in Boston. Now, let's say I've got a nice condo in Boston. A nice condo in Boston is going to cost you about $500,000. For example, let's make it simple, right? So it's $500,000. Let's say I've got that in a nice place in the Seaport or Back Bay. I'm probably renting that out for $5,000. So my rate of return on that asset is 10%. What exactly is the rate of growth in the economy just now?
2%.
Right. So given this, why on earth would I do anything other than own stuff and then lease it and rent it out? Now, we used to call that rentiers, right? People who lived by rents. Mm. And it was this arcane thing of the 19th century, 18th century that supposedly we were done by because we're now all salary earners and so on and so forth. But you know what? That's another part of the message. It's back.
I got to say, Mark Blythe, it's a joy to hear you on the radio. You're the man we call the noisy guy in the Glasgow pub. The Economist, as played by Sean Connery, and it's wonderful to hear you on WBUR. Come back to some of the news of this book, most especially what it's done to the notion we all grew up with, I surely did, that the post-war boom in this country and the expansion of opportunity that my sibs took full advantage of in the late 20th century undid those rules of accumulation, that we could have a social compact. We could have capitalism with a human face, with education, et cetera, a lot of public investment and subsidy for kids like me. Is it gone? Is it over? Is he right about that? What's the truth of it?
Okay, well, he's not saying it's gone, it's over completely. He's simply saying it's under stress. And it's under stress because of that simple relationship. The rate of return on financial assets, essentially, he calls it capital. I think of it more simply as the rate of return on financial portfolio and versus the real rate of growth in the economy. Basically, again, why would you invest in something risky like a business in a relatively low growth economy that's got a lot of risk, will take a lot of time to go, when you can basically live off of financial derivatives or property or some other kind of asset like this? Now, when you do this, right, this is going to create a society where you get increasing returns. Because what happens when you have increasing returns to that is you're going to have the people who have more getting more all the time relative to those who are stuck in the lower growth track of the real economy. So that becomes self-fulfilling in a sense. So you're going to end up with more extreme equality over time. Now, what does this do to the post-war settlement? What does it do to those public institutions? When you have that degree of inequality, those people have the option of private alternatives. And those private alternatives are very, very high quality and very expensive, but they can afford them, private schools, private hospitals, et cetera, et cetera. So they're no longer effectively part of the same society. Now, given the skew of the income distribution, they are, and we hear this claim a lot, also the people who pay most of the taxes, which is true. They pay most of the taxes because they have most of the money. Now, given this, what ends up happening is they say, well, why am I paying taxes for stuff I never actually consume in the first place? Why should I care about city schools when I live in the burbs in a gated community? And that's the type of world that you're creating. Now, when you do this, it's very, very hard to argue for increasing public investments. It's very hard to argue for a redistribution of that wealth, because what is seen is basically what people code as success. But what we're really seeing is essentially the birth of a new rentier class, and that's Piketty's message.
Okay, and that's the simple chart that everybody can see. From Gilded Age to Gilded Age, over 100 years, the proportion of wealth in the top 1% has leveled. It dipped in the mid-century after the war, held pretty firm until the 70s, and now it's way, way up, and it seems to be headed for the sky. Explain that. What happened?
What happened was a couple of things. First one is you got to get familiar with a guy called Simon Kuznets. Simon Kuznets is one of the sort of founding fathers of modern American economics. And Kuznets said, hey, this inequality stuff, let's have a look at this and let's see how this works out. And he did a mini Piketty for the United States back in the day. And he looked at the
very different reading, however.
Yeah, but basically what he was looking at is who has what percentage of income, according, you know, and so on and so forth, and stratified it. And what he found was a kind of a hump shape. So basically he hypothesized that in the 19th century, and sort of go-go capitalism of the United States with no rules and all the rest of it, you get incredibly high returns because there's incredibly high risk and a lot of people fail. But then the ones, your JP Morgans who succeed, etc., they get huge amounts of cash. But over time, capital and knowledge diffuses through the economy. And over time, skills become more important. And that hump begins to crest. And then gradually you begin to get more equality, more equality, not inequality, more equality as the economy becomes more mature. Now, this was an artifact of the data, because it was simply the sample period he took from the 19th century, basically up until the 1930s. What happened, of course, was if you extend the data, and what Pekeri and his colleagues have done is complete the QSNET series, you see that that U is basically one part of what becomes a very, very big hump that goes all the way back up when we get to the end. Now, what caused that? I'm sure that my historian colleague David is going to talk about this at length, but to anticipate some of that from my perspective, financial deregulation. What else happened was the dominance of finance as a mode of production, a mode of accumulation in Anglo-Saxon economies in particular. But and this is
he would also say that two world wars make it an anomaly anyway, that there's so much capital destroyed in that process. That the reading doesn't apply anymore.
Yeah, but I'm going to leave that whole thing to David. I want to concentrate on something else. The real upkick has been since the 1980s. And what has happened since the 1980s? There has been a turn towards financial accumulation as an end in itself in certain economies. There's been a fetishization of labor market flexibility, which has basically meant kicking unions, which has basically meant that the mechanism that workers had to control some share of productivity gains going to them in wages has been eviscerated. It is the platforming of production to global supply chains, which has meant that while global inequality has actually gone down because countries like China have got richer, within country inequality within the developed countries has actually gotten much worse. So there's a huge amount of political and institutional facts here which are very important that are not just about capital destruction in World War II.
I'm almost following you here, Mark, and I've had practice at it. But when you look at the figures, the chart of capital accumulation, I keep wondering if we're seeing sort of the other face of austerity that you've been talking about for as long as I've known you, wealth rising at the top and a kind of stripping down of benefits for in education, in culture, in all manner of programs at the bottom.
No, absolutely. And that goes back to the fact that if you have a small group of people who control most of the investable wealth and pay most of the taxes, they feel no effective tie or need to supply money to, for example, public universities, because they basically bought their way in through legacy points and through donations into the most elite colleges in the world. So if you have two separate societies juxtaposed, why should one subsidize the other?
And do we? I mean, is that the point?
That's what we're trying to avoid. We're meant to all be one society at one point. But what has happened with the rise in inequality is precisely that you end up with two societies pretending to be one.
We're talking about the French sensation this hour, the book everybody's talking about, Capital, by the economist Thomas Piketty.
You know, I think people have been fighting about inequality forever, and you know, certainly they will fight forever, but at least with this book, they know a little bit more of why they are fighting. And what's new in this book is that I put a lot of historical evidence into this debate.
David Kaiser has been teaching and writing history at the Naval War College in Newport for most of the last 20 years. His new book, No End Save Victory, is a chronicle of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's, really of a whole generation's, preparation for entry into World War II. David, Thomas Piketty would tell us that another historic crisis is bearing down on us. Let's tear and compare here.
Well, Franklin Roosevelt is sitting somewhere smiling as he listens to us discuss all this, because it's exactly what he went through. In fact, the book is about preparation for war, but one of the big themes of the book is how the preparation for war was handled by Roosevelt and his men in the same way and on the same basis, really, that they had handled the economic crisis that Roosevelt came in to face. Now, again, this was a financial panic comparable but even worse to what we went through in 2007 and 2008. But in addition, Roosevelt and his leading advisors thought it reflected some fundamental imbalances in the American economy and American society, and they wanted to fix it. Most important of all, though, I think Roosevelt saw this from the beginning as a moral problem. Hmm. And I'd like to quote the way he described it briefly in his first inaugural in March 1933, because it's the kind of language we did not hear, I'm sorry to say, from Barack Obama. And I quote, "Practices of the unscrupulous money changers stand indicted in the court of public opinion, rejected by the hearts and minds of men. The money changers have fled from their high seats in the temple of our civilization. We may now restore that temple to the ancient truths. The measure of the restoration lies in the extent to which we apply social values more noble than mere monetary profit. Mm. Happiness lies not in the mere possession of money. It lies in the joy of achievement, in the thrill of creative effort. The joy and moral stimulation of work no longer must be forgotten in the mad chase of evanescent profits." And
Piketty himself can't match that rhetoric.
No, he can't. And he wouldn't try to because he's a professional economist and they don't talk like that, even him. Now, Roosevelt handled the world crisis the same way. As a moral problem, really, that the world was threatened by anarchy, by dictator powers who knew no respect for law, for their own people, for other peoples. And he and his generation, who had grown up in the chaotic atmosphere of the Gilded Age and who had a lifelong mission of bringing order out of chaos, both at home and abroad. But I would go beyond that because it is fascinating for me to listen to this discussion. Because the New Dealers were keenly aware of the problem Piketty has identified, and they were trying to fix it. They thought the trouble is all the income is going to the same people. We need to increase the purchasing power of the lower classes. We need to get them buying. That will stimulate prices. That will stimulate production. And to some extent, that is what they were able to do. Now, what they really were able to do, and again, this is documented in the book about the early stages of the war, they did that during the Second World War. Now, the last thing I want to say is that Piketty does say again and again in talking about the rise, fall, and rise again of capital, this mid-century period was different. But he's rather vague, at least in the parts of the book I've written, about why. And I would say it was different because of a political commitment that began in the U.S. but spread to Western Europe after the war in particular to make it different. And to spread the economic basis. Go ahead.
I have read your book with great pleasure.
Thank you.
There's a kind of morality. There's a kind of leadership. There's a kind of courage. There's a kind of clarity that we all miss. Very specifically, that Roosevelt himself saw after the fall of France, England in danger, and he looks at the whole North Atlantic and says, "We're next. We're unmistakably embroiled in this conflict." And then he spent almost 3 years getting ready for the intervention. I keep wondering, why haven't we had this book 3 years ago? Who didn't see this crisis on the street, in our own families, and say, wait a sec, let's get busy here at the highest level?
Well, my argument, I'd be interested to hear what Mark thinks about this, which is a bit cynical, is that to an astonishing extent, our thinking class, our journalists, our economists, other academics have been co-opted. They are part of the upper classes. They're not a part of the super rich, but they live very well in general. Their kids are going to the best schools. And it was very difficult for them to take it seriously when it wasn't happening to them. And the Democratic Party, at least since the Clinton administration, has been co-opted and has had a very cooperative relationship with the financial elites. And signally, under Barack Obama, did not attempt to undo the structural changes and the legal changes in our economy, such as the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which have had such a tremendous effect.
Talk about some of that history, why we don't have Glass-Steagall anymore, why we deregulated almost everything, why huge wealth is not taxed as it was even in the Eisenhower days.
Well, there were always, even in the mid-century period, businessmen and conservative politicians who were unhappy. Barry Goldwater spoke up for them in 1964. Theodore White, in his book about the 1964 election, which is probably his best book, speculated in the last pages that Goldwater might be the start of something big. The Democratic Party destroyed its consensus over Vietnam. The Civil Rights Bill gave the Republicans an opportunity in the South. We now know, for instance, from Hedrick Smith's book about Lewis Powell's memorandum before he was on the Supreme Court to mobilize business to change things. And we are seeing the effects of 30 years of sustained effort by business elites and Republicans to undo the New Deal. And in fact, now they're going further, and the Tea Party and extreme Republicans want to undo Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson as well. And from their point of view, they're right. Yes.
I want to introduce Vanessa Williamson, who wrote an important book about the Tea Party and the remaking of Republican conservatism. And she did it the old-fashioned way, by going to endless grassroots meetings and listening very carefully. She is finishing her doctoral thesis in sociology the same way, asking people out there about taxes and then waiting to see where the conversation goes. Well, what did the people make of Piketty's thesis, Vanessa?
Well, I think that I'd say the strong link between what Piketty is writing about, obviously at a very high level, that a vast majority of people, I mean, are never going to read a 700-page economics book, but the link between that book and what people in America really know is that wealth has corrupted our democracy. And this is something you saw across a very wide range of the political spectrum, a deep belief, you know, that all my interviewees worried about lobbyists, worried about where is their money going in Washington? They have no idea. And so I think that that sense that, and many people worried particularly about the bank bailouts, which they can't ascribe to one party or another, and they're right about that. But they sort of see Washington as operating for the few, not the many. And frankly, there's a lot of evidence to support that.
And what's their intuition about the causes here of capital accumulation at rates we've never known?
So one thing that Piketty really deserves credit for is the extent to which people use the phrase 1%. That phrase is, I think, largely due to Piketty and Saez's work, and that is something that average Americans actually say. That's how they talk about the world. And they deserve great credit for that. But I don't think that most people have a clear sense of, you know, these sort of percentages that we've been talking about. And they certainly don't have a clear sense about this question of capital accumulation. It's just not something that most people know. That doesn't mean that they don't have the sort of moral intuition that this country has been taken away from them and that we're not all in it together.
There are contradictions here. The American dream traditionally has not been threatened or felt threatened by adversity, and it's still fed to this day, I think, by a hunger for wealth. We've never quite bought into the European notion, which is the Piketty notion, that the way to wealth, in case you didn't inherit it, is to marry it. We believe in wild successes. And a lot of kids coming out of college today, I think, would tell you it's a wonderful time. Very fruitful technological innovation time, a great time to be taking chances investing. Do you hear that out there or not? This kind of dogged faith in the dream.
I think that people believe deeply in the dignity of work, and that's almost universal. People believe in working hard, and I talk to people, what do they mean by working hard? And they don't mean blue-collar jobs. They mean leaving your family for a long period of time, going to the office and really slogging through, right? So that's something that is a long part of the American tradition, is something that still exists. I did not hear much economic optimism in terms of where the economy is going from young people or old people.
What about where individual people you talk to are going?
Yeah, I think in general, a lot of people are worried about their security, their economic security.
There's another contradiction here, or part of the contradiction turned up in the wonderful Daniel Ariely's, you know, predictable irrationality, or he did basically blindfold surveys, asked people, what kind of a division of wealth do you think would work? Where would you like to live? He also asked them, you know, he showed them pie charts and said, where do you think the American division is? Nobody imagines that 1% own 70% of the goods. And when it's not labeled and you get a sort of, well, the top 10% maybe has 20% of the value and the bottom has, you know, it's a little less than its share. That's what they pick. And it's a profile of Sweden. 92% of Americans, men, women, Republicans, Democrats, would rather live in Sweden than in our distribution. It always made me wonder how Mitt Romney got away with, you know, warning people that they want, the Euro-socialists wanted to ruin our country. Most of Americans of all kinds would love that sort of division. Do you hear that in your kitchen table interviews?
You're absolutely right that people don't have a sense of how big inequality is in this country, right? Even people who use the phrase 1% are going to estimate that incorrectly. But I think that there is also, I mean, I was shocked by the extent to which people are still reiterating the kind of language that I would associate with Reagan, looking down on the poor, looking down on people on welfare in particular. I heard, you know, the classic welfare queen story reiterated to me probably in half my interviews. So the problem, I think, is that people are still looking at the economy, looking down at the guy behind him who's not trying hard enough, and they're not looking up at where all the money went.
What do you make, David, of the real aspirations of fairness, equity, something like equality in this country?
Well, my reaction is that we have to be careful about this phrase, the American dream, which is open to several interpretations. One interpretation is everybody should have their chance to become a hedge fund manager and an investment banker. And for instance, that has characterized, I think, our handling of the race question and the gender question in this country, that we want to open up a certain number of positions to women and minorities at the top. But I think, again, one of the great things about Roosevelt and the New Deal was that, no, we don't want a society which only belongs to the winners, whom we allow to compete to be winners. We want a society in which everybody who works has a decent life, has parks to go to, has vacations, has health care, etc. Now, the Europeans, who suffered much worse consequences of political failure in mid-century than we did, and I think this is the reason. It's no accident that Germany has the most effective welfare state even today. The Europeans have understood that. We still have a lot of trouble about that, and we don't pay enough attention to the kinds of lives that people have to lead. And that's one reason why, as Mark pointed out, we've allowed the labor movement to atrophy almost completely.
Speak for Scotland. Speak for Europe, Mark.
I never speak for Scotland.
Scotland.
Never speak for a
country.
You
sound like Scotland.
Never speak for a country you've left. Anyway, all right, two things are actually very important here. The first one is going back to the question you were asking, you know, how do people feel about this when they'd rather be Sweden, right? Well, first of all, most people have no idea where Sweden is. The second more important point is nobody gets to see the distribution. You don't get to, this way you need to write books like this, right? So what you see is what's locally normal to you. So I'll give you an example. In 2003, there was a Time Maury poll. They phoned up 3,500 Americans and they said, where would you place yourself in the income distribution? But they didn't give them any dollar figures. They just said, do you think you're in the top 10%, bottom 10%, whatever, right? 19% thought they were in the top 1%. And another 10% thought they would get there in their lifetime. Now, you could say, oh my God, this country's delusional. But no, you could say you're locally rational.
No.
When do polling firms phone people up? In the middle of the afternoon, when you're not working, which means you're probably a retiree. So somebody picks you up and says, hey, how are you doing? I'm doing fine. Have you paid off your mortgage? Yeah. Have you got two kids through college because you were part of that golden generation that grew up in the 70s? Yeah. Did you have half your housing debt inflated away in the great inflation? Yeah. How are you doing? I'm fine. Where would you place yourself? I'm top 1%, as far as I can see in my neighborhood. And that's all people really see, and that's what they relate to. It's very important to remember that. You can talk about all the statistics you want, but what's locally rational is what matters. Second point, this isn't just an American story. This is very important. We need to pull this out, and this is what Pekeri makes very clean. This is not just an American story. Sweden has become 70% more unequal since 1990, right? Secondly, Germany may used to have...
Who done it and why?
No, let me finish. Germany used to be sort of this very strong welfare state. It now has a phenomenon after the Hartz reforms on its labour market called mini-jobs, where basically they've created the largest increase in inequality in Europe over the shortest period of time, and it's not the top. It's the bottom of the labour market collapsing because of active government policy to push down wages and force people into employment at sub-wages. So there's a whole story going on here about how inequality is driven by policy as well as by RNG. And this is not just an American story. This is a global story.
RNG, and we've got to come back to that, the rate of return and the growth rate in the economy, which is pay for workers. Vanessa, I want to know what the conservative voices out there, and your ear is tuned to the Tea Party thinking. What's their take on the inequality, the politics of inequality?
Well, I think that one of the things that's really unique about the Tea Party is the extent to which actual Tea Party activists, which are a very small section of America, are more optimistic, at least about engagement in local politics, than most other people I've spoken to. They really do see themselves as capable of making a difference. And, I mean, they have some evidence to back that up. So I think that that's one thing that's really unique about that population. One thing that's true across the board, from Tea Party to the farthest left-wing people I spoke to, is that they are happy to pay for local services. This is something, if you ask people, what are you glad your tax dollars pay for? They are universally happy to pay for schools, for parks, for all the things that they can see in their community. And if you ask them what tax paying is like, they think of it as a responsibility like looking after your neighbors. So I think there's a real space for optimism, too, in the same idea of comparing yourself to your local community, thinking about where you are in the world.
You told me a fascinating thing, that the subject of climate change keeps entering these conversations, whether it's called Katrina or Sandy or tornadoes or drought. Put that into the mix of what people are worried about, what people are hopeful for. In the way of, you know, common action here.
Absolutely. So I think that one thing that has really struck me is the extent to which people, whether or not they associate the disasters they've seen or seen on the news with climate change, believe in paying to fix those problems, right? The number of people who told me about Hurricane Katrina, who told me about Rita, who told me about droughts, and told me that those are things they were willing to pay for, mm-hmm. was exceedingly high. And they, you know, people would go out of their way to say they would pay for people, even people they didn't really like, people who were maybe too rich and hadn't contributed, or people who were too poor and had been relying on welfare. But in these moments of crisis, these moments that we all share, these risks that we share, they were willing to pitch in.
If they grasped the dimensions of the inequality trend, what might be they'd be willing to do about it?
I'm not sure that numbers are the thing that convince people. I think you need a very different kind of story. You know, it's good to tell people how numbers, you know, what the numbers are, because they're important, right? And they're important for policymakers. They're important to understand. But the number of people who, on the one hand, believe that the wealthy should be paying more in taxes, but are unsure whether a progressive income tax is a good idea, was very high. I think that people view the economy, and I think it's reasonable and frankly right to view the economy as a moral question, right? It's about doing your part. It's about exactly, you know, I mean, as FDR often spoke about it, right, that this isn't about some obscure set of numbers. It's about doing the right thing for your fellow Americans.
We're talking about Thomas Piketty's book on capital, on the polarization of wealth and income. We barely mentioned the power consequences of all of that, but the mission in this hour is to fix it, get a cure. Starting one notion, the idea that if the return on investments on capital is bigger than wages, why not, as George W. Bush proposed, put Social Security into the market and give people real equity in America, so to speak? Mark Blythe.
Well, some countries have actually done that, and you'd be surprised by who it is. The first one is Germany, who achieved a greater privatization of Social Security than George Bush even floated. They got 7% rather than 4% of the total funds into the private markets, and the trade unions run the funds. Sweden has actually tied their entire pension system to the value of the Swedish stock market. So there are some countries that have gone quite far this way. Now, this may seem to be sort of like the right-wing swap to a right-wing problem, but I'm actually much more positive on it. Here's a way of thinking about it. If this notion that Piketty has, the rate of return on financial assets is always higher than the rate of growth, then why not get the poor a piece of the action? What's wrong with that? If we have evidence from the only economy we've got that this is consistently true over 200 years, if not longer, why not give them a shot? So here's a modest proposal. You want to fix this. Just now, the Fed's spending $78 billion a month buying, basically, issuing bonds and buying crappy assets from the banks in a policy called quantitative easing. They're pushing that money into the banking system, perhaps 10% of it's getting out in the real economy. It's like taking a fire hose, sticking it into a watering can, and then it ends up in a cup. I've got a much more easy way of doing this. Take half the money for doing that, $500 trillion, and buy equities. Not only will you boost stock prices so that people who already have wealth will get more wealth, you then take those and you put them in a trust fund lockbox and you give them to the bottom 20% of the income distribution, and they don't get to touch it for 20 years. They then get all that equity upside, which they can cash out when they want 20 years later. They can invest it, save it, go to college with it, whatever, but they earn the equity upside too. Why should the rich have all the fun?
David Kaiser-Smiley.
Well, I'm not going to comment on that one. I think the privatization idea took a big hit in the panic of 2008 when we saw what might happen to all our Social Security money. And I'm just a citizen about this, not an expert, but I have my doubts about the future of the financial markets. But I had wanted earlier to take off from something Vanessa said about the welfare queen stories. It is one of the tragedies of American history in my lifetime, I think, that because of the way Lyndon Johnson, whose heart was in the right place, sold the war on poverty, and because it was coincident with the Civil Rights Act, the American people got convinced that poverty was a minority problem. Now, this was crazy. There has never been a moment in the history of the United States when there was a shortage of poor white folks, and there certainly isn't a shortage of poor white folks right now. And yet, that is the way millions and millions of white Americans have come to think about it, and that is why, again, one of the great tragedies of my adult life, when I was young, there was a substantial cadre of white Southern politicians who were progressives on everything but race. And some of them were probably secretly progressive on that too, but they couldn't admit it. And that is now an extinct species. They have been wiped out. So we have to think of this as a problem of distribution that affects everybody. Again, if I may, one of the most moving things I discovered researching my book, I was looking into the election of 1940 and reading newspaper editorials. And almost all the major newspapers were against Roosevelt in 1940, which comes as rather a shock. Two that were not were black newspapers. And one of them, the Amsterdam News, their editorial was what you would expect from an African-American commentator today. They said, well, Roosevelt hasn't been perfect for the Negro, but he's done some good things and we're for him. But the one that moved me almost to tears was from the Chicago Defender, because it just said, we are for Roosevelt because of the great things he has done for the common people of America. And there was not one word in the whole editorial to indicate that this was from a Negro paper. And that made me so proud to be an American, even though that was 70 years ago. And we need that attitude again.
Come back to fixes.
Yes.
Among them, and I think, I don't know what Piketty says exactly about this, but free education, free college education, basically for everybody. Vanessa, do people want it? Mark, would it make sense?
I mean, I think that one of the things people are most comfortable paying for is education, right? They believe in opportunity. They believe in equal opportunity. And they see it as a way of earning that better income in the future that you've invested up front in your education. I think the other policy that I heard very widespread support for was sort of equally simple, straightforward, doesn't involve a complicated tax policy. It's increasing the minimum wage. People across the political spectrum believe in paying people adequately for their work.
Mark Blythe.
But the tragedy of the minimum wage is it's become a ceiling rather than a floor. So now we've actually legalized paying people as little as we possibly can. I mean, one of the comments going back to Romney and the famous 47% is all these people who don't pay taxes. Well, the reason they don't pay taxes is because they earn so little. I mean, that's a reminder of how skewed the distribution has become. That basically you can have a country whereby 30 or 40% effectively pay no taxes and in fact get tax credits because they earn so little. Yet you think about the wealth that the country generates. So again, if you take an international comparison on this, Americans may find this odd, but they're actually undertaxed. Because if you do it internationally, the OECD average is about 43%. When we add it all up, we're at about 35%. We've got plenty of spare tax capacity. The only problem is the people you need to tax in a highly skewed distribution are very good at moving it, hiding it, and making sure you don't find it. And they're also extremely politically connected. So you will find at the state level, while people support state institutions and state institutions of higher education, their budgets have been slashed over the past 15 years. Why? Because you have mainly Republican governors and tax committee pledges that they'll do referenda for the voters and so on and so forth, which means it's very difficult to raise taxes. The cost of higher education increase, you end up with a budget shortfall, you renege on your commitment, and you increase fees. Consequently, it's now more expensive in some cases to go to a four-year public than it is a four-year private when you include the aid that's given when you get to the private.
Piketty speaks of a global wealth tax. He doesn't say who would collect it. Everybody thinks it's naive. He says it could be naive. What about real tax reform, David, in this country? And Vanessa, you too.
Well, I'm skeptical that the global wealth tax could ever happen, and I'm skeptical about Mark's proposal of endowing the lower classes. It's not that I'm against it, but I don't know that it could fly. And I'm sure Mark won't be unhappy if I make a slight correction to what he said. Those lower income people aren't paying income taxes, but they are paying payroll taxes.
And they're paying sales taxes.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. I understand that.
But Piketty also wants, if I remember correctly, he wants to tax income at over $1.5 million at 80%. And I think that would be a wonderful idea. There's plenty of precedent for it in American history. It was actually Herbert Hoover, that's a mistake Piketty makes, who hiked the top rate to 65% in 1932. Roosevelt hiked it further, and it was still 90% in 1964.
We live in a different culture, David, of course.
Well, we do, but it would solve so many problems to do that. And Piketty points out that immediately firms would stop awarding these gigantic bonuses because what's the point if the government's going to take it all? And that would have a healthy effect.
Vanessa Williamson.
I think that, I mean, it's important to know that most Americans believe in a progressive income tax. To what extent do the opinions of most Americans matter for our political outcomes? That's a much more complicated question. But I think that in general, if you could let most Americans know the extent to which people across the income spectrum contribute a lot through sales taxes, through gas taxes and things like that, you'd really have, I think, a lot more willingness to make sure that the wealthy pay their share too.
While we're at it, I want to be sure we're fair to the aggregators of great wealth themselves, known in the First Gilded Age as the robber barons, the late Milton Friedman liked to say we couldn't have built this country without them.
It was the robber barons who were instrumental in building the railroads that joined the country together, who were instrumental in developing the industries of this country, and in thereby providing the opportunities for the ordinary man to improve his lot on life. Everybody can benefit.
That was Milton Friedman, sage of Chicago School Economics, back in, I think, 1979. David Kaiser.
Well, there's been a tragic shift in what leading figures in American business do, and it is exemplified in the difference between two famous Americans, George Romney and Mitt Romney. George Romney took over a failing auto company, American Motors, brought it back to health, employed thousands and thousands of people at a high salary, worked with the UAW, and had relatively liberal political attitudes. Mitt Romney became a venture capitalist, part of whose job was to take over companies and lay off people. And I really do think that one thing someone could do to follow up in Piketty is to ask these hard questions as to what contribution to the broader health of the economy are venture capitalists and hedge fund managers really making? And I'm sure that's a very complex question, but I'm certainly not convinced that they're making a positive contribution for most Americans, and it may even be quite the reverse.
Mitt Romney, able governor of this great commonwealth, would almost do as the poster model of dynastic accumulation and the change in three generations, including his sons. What's to say? Again, this is a sort of a cultural model as much as anything else, but he was the Republican nominee and was in range of doing very well.
Well, this is one of the things that Piketty picks up well, which is that he calls it the new patrimonial capitalism. So if you go back to the time of the Great Depression and you go back to Forbes, you'll find that basically, I think the figure was out of something like 250 listings in Forbes. When you look at it, there was only 30 of them that were actually self-made men. And it used to be true that there was more of that around, but it's becoming more concentrated inherit fortunes. Think of Forbes magazine as an emblem of that, etc. So we're in a sense turning the clock back in this way. So this is obviously an important part of the story going forward, in the sense that why try when you can inherit? Simple as that. Go back to Friedman's quote for a minute. The other side of what he says there is quite interesting. Of course, to build that railroad, you needed a land grant. To build that railroad and put the poles along it that carried the telegraph, you needed a grant and a monopoly contract to do it from the federal government, which is what John Cornell got, and he made so much money he opened up Cornell University.
It's also interesting, by the way, that there was massive overbuilding of railroads in the West in the late 19th century, and they had to be bailed out, and they were.
Is it an iron law, Mark Blythe, that the return on investment has to exceed, century in, century out, the general rate of growth? Now, this is one serious question that I sense is out there about the book and the theory.
Well, it is, and here's one of the issues. Most of the times we haven't been democracies. If you think about when democracy really comes to Europe, it's after World War II. When you think about when full democracy comes to the United States, it's 1965. So we haven't been democracies for a very long time. Now, because of this, democracy creates a problem for unlimited wealth accumulation by a small plutocracy or an oligarchy, right? You can't have these two systems sustainably put together, and yet that's the world that we're building, that's the world that we're living in. So there's a question out there, which is, if you have real democracy, then does that undermine the potential for oligarchy? And if you look at the post-war era, we had capital controls, we had limits on what finance could do, we had limits on foreign exchange trading, there were no derivatives markets, there were no hedge funds, there were none of these specialized investment vehicles that make it possible for the very top to have these increasing returns. We made it possible by changing the law for that to happen. You want to stop it, you can change the law just again. You just need to have a political class that's willing to do it. Unfortunately, as has been pointed out, our political class is pretty much bought and paid for. If you have a look at Congress, you will find out there is basically no one in Congress that earns anything like median income. They are basically all millionaires. And if that is the case, who do they represent and why is anyone shocked by this?
And we're still looking for, as Franklin Roosevelt called himself, or was called, a traitor to his class, a man who said, they hate me and I welcome their hatred. So, The other line out there for a long time now has been that there's no way in our system to vote against Goldman Sachs, to vote against Wall Street. What could be constructed either in an election or a poll, Vanessa, that would tap into the Dan Ariely notion that deep down, and in fact in any blindfold test, we would rather live in a much more equal society.
Well, I think one of the challenges there is that we actually have very few elections that are decided by majority of the people, right? I mean, if you look at the Senate, for instance, the majority rule in the Senate isn't actually abided by because of things like the filibuster. And anyway, the arrangement of senators isn't based on population, and we have a bicameral legislature. So I think that even making those kinds of institutional changes, which would obviously be exceedingly difficult, but we don't even know what the average American would think if they got to vote on things, because they don't. They don't get to.
We wonder about doing a radio show about all of that, hacking the system, making it over, including the filibuster rule, including the Electoral College, mm-hmm. including all manner of things. What's the sense out there among the people you've got to know?
Well, I think that it's relatively rare that people imagine a different system, right? I don't think most people imagine a different way of electing people. And I don't think they're at all aware of the extent to which the rules decide the winner.
Does the appetite for this book, a lot of it sight unseen, and as we've heard, a lot of people who are buying it haven't read it and don't know what's in it, but they've been told this is important, this could save your life or something. Does that tell us something about the political prospect? Just the eagerness to, I mean, the gab around this phenomenon.
Well, this has been a long time in the making. I mean, people confuse what economists call real and nominal changes all the time. So if you ask people, what's the inflation rate, you'll get all sorts of numbers from like 1 to 10 to whatever. You say, what proportion of the federal budget spent on welfare? You end up with like 14%, and we actually spend about as much on parks and recreation if you're talking about cash transfers from the federal government. And the real and nominal one's interesting, because if you say to people, that the bottom 40% of the income distribution in the U.S. hasn't had a real wage increase since 1979. They go, don't be ridiculous. I've had wages. You're telling me I'm earning the same thing then? Yeah, but if you adjust for inflation, really you haven't. And yet the economy's grown by a lot more than that. So where's all the cash gone? It's very hard to get people to make that leap. They live by their everyday experience as well they should, because that's the world that they live in. And that's why it's very difficult to change the politics around it.
What are the exits that people see out there, Vanessa, from this sort of, not Piketty situation, but a Samuel Beckett sort of situation? I can't go on. I'll go on. But what's the next step?
Well, I think that one issue that many people feel would be a tremendous change, would be, or a tremendous improvement, would be campaign finance reform. Yes. People very widely agree that that needs to happen. I mean, they have the sense that these elections are bought and sold. And I don't know if that would solve the entire problem, but that's something that you could get exceedingly wide-ranging support for.
David Kaiser.
Well, I agree with that completely. And Mark talked about the wealth of the people in Congress, but I'm even more depressed that virtually all of them spend 4 hours a day begging people for money. That's what you do as a congressman and senator. Now, if you follow the careers of these people, what you see is that being a congressman has become training for being a lobbyist. Mm-hmm. And why not? You don't need to work as hard. You get more money, and you're the one who decides who's going to stay in the picture, to quote a famous Hollywood story, instead of doing someone else's bidding. And that's how bad it's gotten, and it's another parallel with the Gilded Age.
Little statistic on that. In 1971, 3% of congressmen went on to become lobbyists. It's now 51%.
Oh, my God.
We know these things. We intuit them. We've felt them in our bones for years. Yes. Now what? And does the book help?
The book canonizes. It's a capstone. It's a marker in the road. But at the same time, in terms of popular culture phenomena, I got the feeling this is going to be sort of the year 2000s equivalent of 2010s. How do we even talk about this decade? But whatever this period is, it's going to be the equivalent of A Brief History of Time. Because remember, back in the 80s, everybody bought Stephen Hawking's book and absolutely nobody read it. But everybody kind of knew it was important. I think it's going to be one of those ones. But I think politically more important for the conversation that matters.
Thank you all. Mark Blythe's last book, which I read, was Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea. Vanessa Williamson co-wrote with Theda Skocpol The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism. David Kaiser's new book is called No End Save Victory. You can find other conversations with both Vanessa and Mark on our website, radioopensource.org. There's also a lively discussion already about Thomas Piketty's book, and some great additional materials from our staff economists, Max and Kunal. There's also an interview with Ben Bradley Jr. about Ted Williams. Next week, we're talking about who needs college anymore. This program was produced by Kunal Jasti and Max Larkin. George Hicks engineered it. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.